Hello, everybody, and welcome to the CDH Conversations podcast, this one on competition law and in particular, public interest. My name is Chris Charter. I'm head of the department here at CDH, and I'm joined by one of our gifted senior associates, Duran Naidu, out of Cape Town. Duran, welcome.
Hi, Chris. Nice to be here and looking forward to our discussion.
I wonder if you want to perhaps just set the table in regard to the public interest and where it actually fits in our merger control paradigm in South Africa as a start.
Sure. So the Competition Act provides that the competition assessment and the public interest assessment are essentially two equally weighted legs that the competition authorities must assess when deciding to approve or conditionally approve or prohibit a transaction. And the Act was amended in 2019, which introduced some significant changes, but the five factors that the Act lists under the public interest are whether the merger has an effect on a particular industrial sector or region, employment, the ability of small and medium business or firms controlled or owned by historically disadvantaged persons to effectively enter into or participate in or expand within a market, the ability of national industries to compete in international markets, and the most controversial factor of late, the promotion of a greater spread of ownership, in particular to increase the levels of ownership by HDPs and workers in the markets. So I know that's a mouthful to start off with, but that's essentially where the public interest sits under the Competition Act.
So every merger that is notified to the competition authorities needs to pass through two tests. One is the competition test. Does your merger substantially prevent or lessen competition? And then the other test is, what is the impact of your merger on the public interest? And can or cannot the merger be justified in the public interest? So I think, Duran, is it correct to say that that's, for years, has been kind of something very unusual in our Act, to have the public interest assessment hardwired in that way into the competition assessment? And for years, we've been criticized as a jurisdiction which overreaches in terms of the investigatory mandate to go beyond pure competition issues and consumer welfare, which is the traditional approach, and to say, but hang on, mergers can also affect the public interest. It can affect jobs. It can affect barriers to entry for small businesses, can negatively affect a region. And of course, the opposite is also true. It can positively affect all of those factors. Whereas we've been subject to criticism for many years, I think what strikes me as interesting is that all around the world now, a lot of regulators are starting to pick up on the fact that merger activity has effects on an economy, has an effect on value chains beyond pure consumer welfare-based effects. So increasingly, a lot of other jurisdictions in Africa and even in the developed world are starting to look at public interest factors, and in particular, things like the effect on employment and small businesses when they're assessing mergers. So for the first time in forever, to some extent, people are starting to see things the same way that the Competition Commission does and that our Act does. But I wonder if perhaps we shouldn't rest on our laurels for too long, because of course, you know, we do have some challenges with our public interest assessment. And maybe it's worth looking at that, Duran, through the lens of competition policy versus competition law. In your experience as a competition lawyer notifying mergers, how have you perhaps seen the shift in policy from a public interest perspective as it's developed over the years?
So I would say pre-2019, when the Act was amended substantially and specifically regarding the requirement to promote HDP ownership, it seemed to me that employment was the primary focus of the competition authorities. I mean, when we were filing mergers, that was the central or one of the most important factors that we would consider from a timing perspective and a complexity perspective, as well as what conditions could be imposed, was employment. But once the 2019 amendments came in, it shifted slightly. Employment was still a paramount factor and still is today, but the focus on the promotion of HDP ownership in light of the specific language used in the Act, the word promotion, the Commission adopted quite a robust approach to that section. And the first important step in this process since 2019 would probably be the Burger King case, where the Commission prohibited it essentially because there was a reduction in HDP ownership. It eventually was approved subject to certain conditions being tendered by the merging parties. But that was a seminal moment in the public interest regime, really, and set the tone for what has come since then, which is what appears to me the Commission has taken a slightly more flexible approach of late in 2024. But I would say over the previous 2 years, there's been quite a binary approach, a little bit mechanical in some ways. It's quite difficult to advise clients sometimes exactly how to deal with this.
I think you're right. I think it's interesting to see how the public interest framework has developed over the years. And I think in the early days, it was probably seen more as a second-tier inquiry. In other words, it was more used if your merger was, in principle, perhaps not great for competition. Notionally, you could say, but it's great for the public interest. And it really was a backseat in terms of the approval process. And then over time, it gathered more traction. And I think exactly as you say, I think the first thing to really bite was the effect on employment. And I'm reflecting on, you know, when that started to bite, and we're now probably talking 15 years ago, where it suddenly became clear that a merger between two otherwise profitable companies who weren't planning any retrenchments in the ordinary course, if that merger resulted in operational overlap such that retrenchments made sense, that that would be considered a negative public interest factor. In other words, the commission would say, if this merger wasn't happening, then we would not have these job losses. Therefore, the merger causes job losses, and job losses are bad. And of course, you know, in more recent years, job losses are particularly bad looking at our unemployment rate. And so it became pretty much par for the course that the commission would look at that carefully and almost invariably impose some sort of a condition limiting, if not outright prohibiting, the extent to which a merger could beget job losses. And I'm reflecting on the fact that there was a time when that was complete anathema and everybody clutched their pearls and said that is no way to run an economy on a regulated basis. Who is going to invest in South Africa if you make calls on that kind of thing? We need efficient companies and they should be allowed to do whatever they want to do. And the efficiency will drive economic growth. And in the end, that's good for everybody. But despite that momentary horror, it's now very much part of our approval landscape. It's not controversial, I don't think, to just about anybody that if your merger is going to result in job losses, that you've got a lot to answer for before you can get approval. And you might not be allowed to effect those job losses. So that was kind of where we came to. And then what became another key imperative in South Africa, and I think we need to talk about it in the context of public interest, is the question of transformation. It's impossible not to have a discussion on that, knowing the skewed nature of our economy. And obviously, it's an important industrial policy, potentially, to say that, well, you know, the powers that be should be doing everything they can to foster a more equal economy from a transformation and ownership perspective. And that policy began to bleed its way into the way the commission looked at mergers. But it was very difficult for them to specifically drive any kind of a transformation agenda through merger control. The policy had become clear, but the act wasn't quite there. So in 2019, they proposed a number of amendments, one of which was to introduce a new public factor. And Duran, you mentioned it. This is the question of the impact of the merger on the promotion of a greater spread of ownership, be it by HDPs, historically disadvantaged persons, or workers. And this is where things get interesting. Because the new legislation was driven very much by policy, there was an attempt to create space for these emerging policy trajectories without being particularly clear in the act. And of course, you know, as any lawyer will tell you, that's bad drafting. But what it has allowed the commission to do is develop its policy further. And what they're now doing is they are interpreting that requirement as a positive obligation in any given merger to increase the spread of ownership so that post-merger, there is a greater ownership by either HDPs or workers. And while it might be, from a bird's eye perspective, difficult to take issue with that as a philosophy, making the economy more accessible and to share it with a greater number of previously marginalized sectors, that is difficult to argue with from an ideological point of view, I suppose. The real question is, in the context of mergers, whether it is appropriate to impose that kind of a positive obligation. Because unlike with employment, and I think this is the key issue, conditions on ownership don't stem from a merger which reduces the level of employment. Because with any conditional approval, you're trying to protect the pre-merger situation if it's perceived that that situation is better than what the merger will result in. But with ownership, the commission has taken a view, certainly over the course of the last 18 months or so, a fairly strong view, which is to say that any merger that comes before it has to increase the levels of ownership. So even if your merger doesn't reduce the levels of ownership, in other words, it remains the same. In order for the commission to approve your merger easily, you will need to demonstrate an increase. That effectively is a requirement on every transaction to include, regardless of how it was initially thought, an equity component, whether that is an ESOP, an employee share option scheme, or a BEE partner. And that is something that is continuing to prove difficult, I think, for investors to wrap their minds around. But Duran, I did say that in order to get your merger through easily, you would need to do an equity deal. And you mentioned of late, the commission has become a little less binary on that. Do you want to explain to listeners what you mean by that in terms of what other options there are to solve for a situation where you are unable to introduce an equity partner in the form of either a worker scheme or a HDP partner?
Sure. So of late, there have been instances where merging parties haven't been able to, or the commercial realities of the transaction didn't facilitate ESOP or HDP transaction. And the commission has been amenable to receiving creative public interest packages, which essentially cater to the other public interest factors in the Competition Act and the total quantum of those, or that basket of factors that the parties are offering as conditions, are intended to counterbalance and outweigh the perceived harm on the HDP ownership requirement. And when I say harm, that's even in the case where it's a neutral transaction from an HDP perspective, when it's 0-0 or 20-20 even. Parties are putting forward a basket of factors as public interest conditions. And a few examples of those would be localization initiatives, procuring from HDP service providers and suppliers in the specific regions emerging parties operate in, as well as offering bursaries to learners. It can be anything, a wide range of factors that, as long as they merge specific and fall within the public interest factors in the Act, the Commission are amenable to receiving those. But you also need to have a cogent reason as to why you're not doing an HDP ownership or ESOP transaction, because the Commission are looking for that in the first instance. And only once you can show that you don't have a good reason for doing that, they look at the basket of other factors and what you can put forward to countervail that perceived harm.
Thanks, Jan. That's exactly it. I think to just draw a line under where we may be today on public interest. And the funny thing about the intersection between competition law and policy is that the law is in principle immutable. The policy shifts. So when I say where we are today, that may be very different to where we are tomorrow. And it certainly seems to be different from where we were yesterday. Where we seem to be, and this is, I think, what deal makers or investors, anybody who's involved in an M&A transaction really does need to come to terms with, is that for better or for worse, we have a piece of legislation which requires any merger to pass through a public interest lens. And clearly, if your merger is bad for any of the public interest factors, you've got a problem. I don't think that's particularly controversial. What has proven controversial is the notion that in order to justify your merger, you need to show an improvement in the level of ownership in order to address transformation objectives in the broader economic sphere, broader societal sphere. That might not be objectionable from an end justifying the means point of view, but what it does do is it effectively imposes quite a significant tax on merging parties specifically. So this is not a law of general application that says, you know, all businesses require a license and that license requires a certain level of BEE empowerment or worker participation. This is simply to say, because you've had the gumption to propose a merger, you now have to do more than your competitors in that you must give up equity effectively in the interests of broad transformation objectives. And I think that is a pretty scary thought, that that should be part of the equation. Now, the Commission has to some extent been willing to engage on a broader suite of public interest undertakings, but those still cost money. In other words, if there's a good reason why you cannot introduce an equity component to your transaction, you will still need to demonstrate a willingness to spend a not insignificant amount of money in order to show that your merger will benefit the transformation in other ways. And that can be done through investments in the value chain, supplier development, customer initiatives, skills development, all of those things. And in fact, there's quite a lot to choose from. The Commission is increasingly open to commitments on sustainability, educational initiatives, and the like. Now, that's, again, probably resulting in some good outcomes in the broad societal sense. But I think we have to ask ourselves, to what extent is that chilling an appetite for investment, both foreign and domestic? Because although deals are still happening, the number of deals, merger flow, is a very good bellwether for the strength of an economy. And I don't think it's controversial to suggest that our economy, and perhaps the world economy, at the moment is flat at best, declining at worst, which means we have far fewer M&A transactions happening. And M&A transactions are overwhelmingly good for the growth of an economy because it shows trust in an economy. It shows trust in growth. It shows that sentiment believes that by investing in companies in a particular economy, that there is money to be made. And failing to invest shows exactly the opposite. So I think we do need to be concerned about to what extent the current public interest regime is making it more difficult for investors in an already very difficult investment environment. And I suppose one has to think about, like any policy, whether that should shift, even just temporarily, to say, well, let's try and first get our economy back in track. Because as much as it's difficult to counter the notion of inclusive growth, which is a wonderful slogan, without growth, you can't have inclusive growth. So I think that is something that we need to continue to wrestle with.
If I can just add to that, I think we need to consider South Africa's overall competitiveness and our attractiveness for foreign investment versus other African countries, and how the Commission approaches its policy and ease of doing business and transaction timing. We want to make ourselves appear to be as attractive as possible to stimulate that growth. So I think a pragmatic approach by the Commission is obviously the best approach for growth, if that's your ultimate goal.
Absolutely. And I do sympathize with the Commission. They are somewhat between a rock and a hard place. I think they don't want to be seen as investor unfriendly. And I think they do recognize the importance of not just foreign investment, but investment generally. And yet they are faced with a specific mandate in terms of the Competition Act to consider the public interest. But I do think that there is sufficient scope within the Act for them to take a pragmatic view and to perhaps reassess their policy from time to time. And maybe it's a discussion for another day as to where that policy should head. At the moment, there is some flux. And maybe if we can just end off, Duran, for our listeners, to just maybe leave everyone with some key takeaways. We can lament the public interest test all we want and suggest that perhaps it's not doing enough to stimulate growth in the M&A space and therefore heat and growth in the economy generally. But practically speaking, the law is the law. The policy is what it is. We do have a good sense of it. So what should we be advising deal makers when they're going into a transaction? What are the ways in which one can perhaps best manage this public interest conundrum?
I would say to fully grasp the ambit of the public interest impact or the transaction's impact on the public interest as early as possible in the transaction process. And if you're dealing with foreign clients or if you are a foreign client, you should probably get your competition lawyers involved as early as possible so that they can sketch the roadmap for your competition approval in South Africa. The earlier you build your public interest into the deal itself, you'll get an ability to avoid delays and just be ready to deal with certain issues that may arise on the public interest front when the transaction's ultimately notified to the commission.
I think that's absolutely right. So the key question here is keep your eye on the playing field here. Do not be naive in the notion that the commission will treat your merger as the be-all and end-all of a good thing. Understand that you'll be looked at from a public interest perspective. And I think ultimately, if buyer and seller can accommodate public interest commitments in line with the commission's policy, then you will have a far easier time of your merger approval. Of course, that said, there are certainly paradigms where that is simply not possible. And I think that the time is probably nigh for something of a test case, where perhaps it will come to a point where an investor with the gumption to do so will perhaps be willing to find a transaction which is overwhelmingly good for the public interest, but perhaps can't accommodate an ownership component, and to simply take that to the adjudicators, to the tribunal, to test the commission's policy. And I will say that there is something to be said on occasion for that, because the commission would prefer not to run a test case. Its modus operandi with public interest to date has been really to try and force buy-in from merging parties. And they do have that power because merger activity is very much time sensitive. And so the fact that the commission is the gatekeeper and can hold up your transaction, introduce levels of friction, has often resulted in a simple assessment of the time value of money and the risk of further delay compared to the additional expense of making public interest commitments. And that is more often than not led to capitulation and undertakings, which the commission then treats as precedent. But of course, none of this is in fact legal precedent. It's not a finding by the tribunal as to exactly what the scope of the public interest mandate is. And I think at some point, and I think it might happen relatively soon, that is going to be tested. And then we'll have to pick the seaweed from our teeth after that tsunami of litigation and work out where we are again. So as always, doing business in South Africa is exciting, not without its challenges, but the opportunities are there. And there is the prospect of a good outcome for those who are A, well-advised, and B, willing to engage with both the legal and policy paradigm.
I couldn't agree more.
We can leave it there for now. And this is a conversation that will continue in the coming months, I think, on competition issues, including the public interest, which remains, I think, one of the key things weighing on investors' minds. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.